wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew. Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if out my heart I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know, yeah. And I'd sing, hang, 'cause I know, yeah. Then I'd sing, hang, 'cause I know.
Welcome to the Prison Voices Project here on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Karanja Keita Carroll. On this morning's show, we focus on the impact of mass incarceration on the family. Co-producer Alexandra Cox and a member of the Prison Voices Collective interviewed Megan Comfort, author of Doing Time Together, Love and Family in the Shadow of the Prison. And she interviewed Gina Clayton, Executive Director of the SC Justice Group. We will also include a third interview with Danielle Wallace, Assistant Professor of Africana World Studies at William Paterson University in New Jersey, who recently presented a paper entitled The Missing Ones, The Effects of Mass Incarceration on Black Marriages and Families at Monmouth University's Biennial Conference on Race and Racism. Music from this week's show comes from Wise Intelligent, Naruba, Salah, and Divine RBG featuring M1. Let's get things rolling with Naruba, Salah, Gun Law.
Be ready once that war has gotten heavy. Kept them burners by the bevy. Turn that defense to confetti. Steady aiming where your children at. Damage where you building at. Annihilate you from the map. This is more than just a rap. Presidents crying over babies. Don't move me. But they've been killing babies worldwide. You can't fool me. Just another tactic to take us off our axis. That routine practice to keep us on snooze. Everyone's associated. I don't watch the news. Claiming I'm affiliated. I don't know them dudes. I just keep it front line, 12 gauge shot rhyme. Aim for the head, make sure the shoulder don't bruise. I choose freedom over cake and find royalties. Even for the sake to integrate in popularity. Just for more clarity, you ain't really scaring me. It's really no surprise to anyone with open eyes to this. Demagogue, label you an outlaw. Confiscate your gun law, come into your crib then pinned up, got your family hemmed up. Even with your chin up, you can't feel your manhood. Slowly turn around and tell your family get down. No one make a sound and put your face into the ground. Anything said again, we pump that hot lead again. This is all American, take that. Justice simple question. We don't manufacture weapons. How we get them Smith & Wessons, how they circulate the hood. They bring them here in boats, mainly for the youth to tote. Send them pigs to get them yoke. We have a vigil, all good. But I'm from school of fist fights. Jump you if you sing psych. Ruger AK, just in case they want my birthright. Man, it's right. NRA is in the bed with government. Same aim, same different name, same covenant. Media, working overtime to put the fear in ya. Church praying hard, but that blonde ain't really hearing ya. Area, a war zone for all the wrong reasons. And other countries killed for lacking water in their region. Squeezing, imitating Scarface and Al Capone. Time for battle and they'll be hot until the smoke's gone. Had them dogs at your door like a 64. Hope he missed pointless, he never missed before. Demagogue, label you an outlaw. Confiscate your gun law. Come into your crib, then pinned up, got your family hemmed up. Even with your chin up, you can't feel your manhood. Slowly turn around and tell your fam to get down. No one make a sound and put your face into the ground. Anything said again, we pump that hot lead again. This is all American, take that back. Plan for civil war, and if you ask me, the blueprint, mandatory weapon for the family. Candidly, Nat Turner, burner most amiably. Make his soul go from the flow to the canopy. Some say I'm violent, and I should stay silent. Meanwhile, strip us of our right to defend ourselves, but my team keep the magazines clean with the hollow peas, red, black, and green bandanas on the shelves. Combat boots for the soldiers, all 12s. Comedic lexicon over prepaid cells. This is why they terrify, fear that we'll get unified. Realize the war is on us and break hell. And of course, they'll offer support when it's popping off. Give you proper transport, show you to the Holocaust. It's a siege outside, no man is safe from. You can hide, but you can't run. Mazel tov. Demagogue, label you an outlaw. Confiscate your gun law. Come into your crib, then pinned up, got your family hemmed up. Even with your chin up, you can't feel your manhood. Slowly turn around and tell your fam to get down. No one make a sound and put your face into the ground. Anything said again, we pump that hot lead again. This is all American, take that back.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm Alexandra Cox, and I'm an assistant professor of sociology at SUNY New Paltz. Today, I interviewed Megan Comfort, who is a researcher who has written a book about the effects of incarceration on the loved ones of people who are incarcerated called Doing Time Together. And I also had an opportunity to interview Gina Clayton, who is the executive director of the SE Justice Group based in California. And it's an organization which Megan Comfort sits on the board of and does great work trying to build leadership and connection amongst women who have been affected by incarceration. I'll begin today's show with an interview with Megan Comfort.
I'm Megan Comfort, and I am a senior research sociologist at RTI International, and I wrote a book called Doing Time Together, Love and Family in the Shadow of the Prison that came out in 2008.
And what is RTI International?
RTI International is Research Triangle Institute International, and so it's a research institute that's actually based in North Carolina, in the Research Triangle, but we have a lot of regional offices, and I'm based in the San Francisco office on the other side of the country.
And what led you to do the research for your book?
So it started out for me actually not as a research project. I had a long-standing interest in kind of issues of social justice and incarceration and what was happening in our country along those lines in the early and mid-90s when I was getting my life started as a young adult. And one of the first jobs I got that was incredibly meaningful to me was working at the visiting center at San Quentin State Prison. So in California, there's legislature that mandates that every prison has to have a visiting center that is specifically dedicated to helping the visitors. So it's not a visiting area, it's where, you know, people can go for services when they are coming to that prison as visitors. And the one at St. Quentin's really special because it's actually located outside of the gates of the prison, and it's owned by a nonprofit organization called Center Force that does a lot of advocacy work around prisoners and their families. And so I got my start there, and I was originally hired to be the child care coordinator. We had a great program for children where either mothers could drop off children on their way into the prison if they didn't want the kids to go in at all, or a really neat and fairly unique program where we would also go in around lunchtime on the visiting days with a van and pick kids up. And I just really loved that because it meant that kids could go in and visit for a while with their fathers or uncles or brothers or grandfathers, whoever they were there to see. But they didn't have to stay in all day. And so we would take them out and they could come and run around. All that kid energy would just burn off and we'd feed them pizza and have fun art activities and all sorts of things, which also meant, of course, that the adults could stay in and have a little adult time to visit. So I started there and loved that job and worked there for a couple of years and gradually got to know some researchers who were conducting research out of that visiting center. And so for me, that really sparked my initial interest in, you know, the other side of the walls that was still so intimately linked to the people inside.
And can you talk a little bit about, in particular, what you found about the impact of incarceration on intimate partnerships and relationships between people on the inside and people on the outside?
Sure. I think there's been a lot of growth in our understanding of all of this in kind of the last 10 years, which has been very exciting, you know, as more people really think about it and do conduct research on it and are just more aware of the issues. And so, you know, to answer that question is kind of a very broad, you know, there's a lot going on basically. But I think one of the most important points is that we used to really have a false image, but a strong image of prisoners as being sort of lone wolves, and they were very isolated. You know, they went into prison and nobody heard from them for years, and they were completely cut off from society. And, you know, we definitely see now that people who are incarcerated continue to be very connected to people on the outside. Obviously, those connections can get disrupted in some ways, and there's a lot that happens when someone's incarcerated that puts up barriers to that connectedness and communication. But really where my work is focused is on, you know, the people on the outside, largely women, who are making incredible efforts to overcome those barriers. And so people who do maintain relationships in one form or another during an incarceration period. And so, as I say, you can kind of see a whole bunch of different things going on for people. So much depends on kind of who they are and how their relationship was, and then things like, you know, distance to the facility and what kinds of economic resources somebody has, because I'm sure everyone listening to this knows it can be really expensive to maintain contact. Phone calls are outrageously expensive, and then visiting can cost a lot. And So a lot varies, and within that is sort of what people are able to do. But I think one of the enduring messages that I've gotten from the work that I've done is that people are incredibly creative and dedicated and ingenious in the ways that they do find to maintain their relationships. And so it's really important for us to try to get a strong sense of what people are doing and what kinds of support and help they might need to keep those relationships in a you know, strong place the way that they want to.
Could you kind of give a specific example for the listeners, if you could give them kind of a visual picture of what it's like to enter San Quentin for a typical person who's coming to visit their loved one? What would a kind mm-hmm. of trip there look like for them? And what would they have to kind of go through?
That's a great question. So, San Quentin's very interesting. So you arrive and you park in a parking lot that's actually still outside of the gate. So I've heard that in some prisons, you know, your car is searched and all of those things. You're technically on state property at San Quentin, but you can just drive right in and park. I used to park my own car there when I was doing my research. And then you come into this area that people talk about as the tube, which is basically a long concrete hallway with a door on each end, so people are coming in at each end, and just some hard wooden benches and a few lockers and nothing else. And this was the place where I really began my research once I decided I wanted to study what was happening to people. And it's a really important place because a lot of, again, women and children are spending hours there every time they come to visit, because they either come early before visiting hours start because they want to get a good place in line, or they just show up and the line is really long and it ends up taking several hours to get through there. So people wait, and as I said, there's not really a lot of seating, and if you are seated, you're seated on a pretty hard bench, and if you have any sort of mobility issues or if you have a little kid, you know, it's really, really difficult and uncomfortable. And after a while, you finally get buzzed through the main door, and that's when you really enter the prison, technically. And so you come in, you give your ID over to someone, get checked to make sure you're in the system, and that's a place, and again, I'm sure listeners will be familiar with these kinds of things that happen, that sometimes somebody's been waiting in line, you know, literally for 2 or 3 hours, and she finally makes it inside that door and hands over her ID, and they either tell her she's not on the visitor list, or they tell her that the person she's come to visit has been transferred to another facility, or is at court that day, or for whatever reason she can't see him. So that was incredibly heartbreaking to watch that happen to people who had put so much effort into getting there and then literally just made it inside the door and were turned away. If you're more fortunate than that, then you go through the process of, you know, walking through the metal detector and sending things through for x-ray. And San Quentin has a lot of visitors. It's actually very close to some major cities. So compared to places that are more isolated, you have a fair number of people coming in. So they actually have a pretty streamlined system, and they don't do a lot of, you know, searches and pat-downs and those kinds of things unless the metal detector goes off. And once people come through for that, they walk up a long, long sidewalk that takes them into the heart of the prison, and then it depends a bit on, you know, where they're going to get to the visiting rooms. And as, again, people would be familiar, once people get there, then they go through another check of their ID and everything and ultimately end up into the visiting room, where they wait again, sometimes for a while, for the person that they've come to see to show up. So it's a pretty arduous process.
And it sounds like someone would typically spend up to a full day, both in terms of travel and getting inside and then spending time inside.
Yes, I think that's, you know, most people's experiences, unless, as I say, they're the unfortunate ones who get turned away and only spent half a day because they never actually made it into the prison. But I definitely saw a lot of people committing entire days. And for people who were coming, San Quentin's in Northern California, but people would drive up or fly up from Southern California, and those people might spend an entire weekend making that full trip.
In your work, you talk about this almost like secondary prisonization. Could you kind of explain what that means, or what you think that means to the listeners?
Sure, yeah. This is a concept that I borrowed the original concept, which is the concept of prisonization, from a sociologist named Clemmer. And Clemmer came up with this idea that when people spend a good amount of time in a prison, they start to adapt, you know, different habits and the way that they talk and the way that they dress to the rules and regulations of the prison. Again, listeners might have some sense of this for themselves, how those things take place over time. So you start to even like crave specific foods that are the foods that you're given, you know, as a treat when you're inside, or maybe something that your whole kind of routine shifts to accommodate a prison schedule and prison regulations. And I was really interested in that because as I saw women coming to visit, and as I interviewed them and spent more time with them, I could actually see signs of this happening for them. And so women, for example, would tell me that, you know, the prison has very strict regulations on women's clothes. And again, I think this is kind of typical for a lot of facilities. San Quentin's pretty difficult in that the prisoners themselves wear blue jeans, and so women aren't allowed to wear blue jeans, which is what a lot of people, you know, originally show up in until they learn they can't wear these things. But then all the other regulations that people may be familiar with, you know, skirts have to be a certain length, and you can't have like a slit in the skirt that comes up too high. At San Quentin, there are no bare shoulders, so everything has to be at least short sleeves, if not long sleeves, et cetera, et cetera. And so women would explain to me that, you know, because of their restraints on their budgets, and also because they were just tired of having to think through all of these things every time they would come up, they basically only bought clothes that they could wear into the prison. So when they would go shopping, they would just disregard any clothing that wouldn't make it into San Quentin, and they would only buy what they would call prison clothes. And so I thought that was a really profound example of the secondary prisonization idea, where, you know, technically the women were free to buy other clothes or to wear other clothes, but because of their contact with the correctional facility over time, they basically just adopted this new form of dress that conformed to the rules and regulations of the prison. So in the book, I talk about, you know, lots of different ways that this happens in the way that women would, you know, food that they would eat, the way they would organize their daily schedules to be home at certain times, because those were the times when they knew that their incarcerated loved one could call them, and just, you know, all sorts of different ways that women became sort of secondary prisoners living outside of the walls, but really connected to the walls themselves.
Could you talk about some of the financial costs of incarceration for people who have loved ones inside?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, as I'm sure you and listeners know. Certainly the first thing that comes to mind is this phone call issue, which there's, you know, been some good advocacy around, but it's amazing that things have not shifted for the better and have really stayed in this state of families being massively overcharged for phone calls. Most of the women I talked to, that was their number one financial burden, was phone calls. Phone bills that would reach up to astronomical proportions, sometimes putting women in a really tough bind where they felt like they needed to cut their phones off or to not accept any more calls from their loved one, which they hated to do emotionally, but it was just completely untenable financially. They were literally overwhelmed with the phone bills. Then as we were speaking about before, I mean, you know, all those long visits, there can be travel costs and gas costs and maybe buying new clothes that are going to fit for the prison rules. For some women, there may be childcare that they need to arrange if they can't bring their child with them for any reason. And if they don't have a lovely visiting center like we were able to have where childcare was free. Eating, you know, if people are on the road, they have to buy food at fast food venues, or once they get up to the prison, usually vending machines are the only thing that they can eat out of, and often they're wanting to bring some sort of, you know, treat for their loved ones, so they bring money so that their loved one can buy stuff out of the vending machines. So visits end up being very costly. And then something that was important at the time I did my research and that I think has shifted a lot in terms of what's permissible is sending packages. Women loved to send packages into their loved ones and, you know, spent a lot of time and energy and money on those. Unfortunately, there have been a lot of regulations that have put into place now where women can't make those packages themselves. They have to go through a vendor. So I think that that has taken a lot of the pleasure that women got out of assembling a package themselves, but has kept the financial burden because those vendors are even more expensive than they would have been if women could select their own goods. So it's kind of all of those, like, actual direct costs. And then, you know, there can be a lot of indirect costs in that women may do something like change their work hours so that they can be available for visiting or receiving phone calls, and that might mean shortening their work schedule, maybe losing some of that work time or going on to a night shift instead of a day shift. And some of those things, and another big area of research right now is how the stress of all of this can affect loved ones of prisoners. And, you know, we're getting pretty concerned about how all of this stress is translating into heart problems and, you know, different health problems that are going to end up costing that person money for her own health, but also going to cost society money in terms of, you know, providing health care to people. So it really is a big, big part of this whole maintaining contact piece.
Wow. And I guess, I mean, you spoke a little bit about the pleasure of putting together a package. I wonder if you can kind of comment a little bit on what you saw as some of the ways that the kind of joys and pleasures of the visit and the experience of staying connected for people on the inside and the outside.
Right. A big piece of that, and again, I think this will be familiar to people listening, is people on the outside worry so much about how their loved one is doing. And so a lot of times I heard from women that the visit, it didn't even matter kind of what was said. It was just important to see the person that they love in front of them, safe, you know, alive and hopefully looking somewhat healthy. And that was a big motivator for people to show up at the prison, just to have that reassurance. People also do, I mean, phone calls are monitored, you know, by people listening in on them, and they're short. San Quentin, they were limited to 15 minutes. So to be able to have an in-person conversation where you're still in a room with a lot of people, but there's not one person actively listening to your full conversation right at that minute, was also something that people really appreciated. Something that I think was consistently brought up as being difficult and that I do think is a big important thing for us to pay attention to in terms of these types of relationships and how we might be able to help people make them stronger, is a lot of women would tell me that they were unwilling or reluctant, at least, to bring up difficult topics of conversation during a prison visit because they really wanted the visit to go well, right? And they wanted to have a nice visit, and they wanted themselves and their loved ones to be able to leave the visit feeling calm as possible and, you know, solid and good. And they were worried that if they brought up difficult or challenging topics or any kind of sad topic, that visit might not end that way. And that would be really hard for them when they left. So I think when we're thinking about, you know, and then of course, if you're having a phone call, the same thing comes in because somebody's actually listening to your call. So you don't really want to talk about anything too personal or sensitive. So that's been something in terms of recommendations and trying to think about how we could strengthen programs for prisoners and their loved ones, of really trying to give people the support to talk about things they might need to talk about, because usually the incarceration period is not easy for people on the inside or the outside. And, you know, how can we make conversations happen in a place that's a little safer for people, where they feel like they're going to be able to have a full conversation? You know, women were worried, well, if I bring something up and it's overcrowded and then all of a sudden they tell me I have to leave in the middle of this conversation, I'm going to be really upset. Or people were worried about themselves crying, or even if their loved ones started crying, that other people in the visiting room would see that and gossip about them. So I think there's a lot we could be doing there to really help support people in having conversations about important and sensitive issues for their family life and relationships in these environments that right now aren't very conducive to that.
I think that's a good segue to my last question, which is sort of, you know, what you think are like the kind of the questions that remain for you about what could be done to in the short term sort of impact on these effects of incarceration on people who are connected to those who are incarcerated.
This is actually a really exciting time for that, I think. As I mentioned, there are a lot more people kind of in different fields, you know, certainly a lot more researchers paying attention to these issues, but I feel like a lot more policymakers and, you know, correctional administrators, and in general, I think people are getting to a point of really thinking this through more, and so hopefully we're going to be able to see some movement on it. And I think the first step in that, which is happening right now, is just really mapping out these impacts and, you know, recognizing that we don't incarcerate one person. We you know, incarcerate an individual and have all these effects on his or her loved ones and people who are connected to them. And so trying to see, well, what is happening for those folks, and, you know, what kinds of stresses and difficulties and challenges are coming into their lives because of an incarceration. And then it becomes a lot about trying to address those in multiple ways. I think there are the kind of concrete things, like I was just saying, can we change the visiting room conditions? Can we change even the signing up for the visits, right? Like, is there a way to prevent it so that somebody would know ahead of time that the person she came to visit isn't at the facility anymore, or that she's not on the list yet? You know, so starting from there, all the way up through making visiting rooms more child-friendly so that kids feel more comfortable and parents can interact in a more, you know, relaxed way with their kids during a visit, to providing safe private spaces for people to have conversations. So there was kind of that very concrete way of looking at things. There's also, as I say, a lot of new work showing the health implications and stress that's happening for people who are trying to remain connected to an incarcerated loved one. And I think there's a lot we need to be doing around providing support groups and having physicians, you know, talk to people about how they might be able to support their health during a really challenging time. And then this certainly goes all the way up to the point of also trying to consider more thoroughly you know, is incarceration necessary? Are there times when, you know, the damage that this is going to inflict on a family outweigh whatever reason there was to try to incarcerate someone? And can there be some alternatives to that kind of sentencing? And preferably programs that involve the family, because a lot of times, you know, these are a resource. These are people who love someone enough to go through all of this for them. So is there a way to engage the family in a productive and supportive role that could also not bring as much harm onto the family? So it's, as I say, I feel optimistic. I've been doing this work for about 20 years now, and I definitely feel this is the time when I've seen the most energy and the most discussion around these issues. So I am really hoping that we might be moving in a positive direction right now.
Y'all feel that? That piano was good. This is it right here, PJ. This is it.
Given a chance to do it again, I would probably change a few things. I'd listen to me a bit more. I travel the world with three brides, no hate to each his own. My name would no longer be Wise, you call me Jesus Jones. Pop off the hammer for jurors, return of a prodigal son. Go tell your favorite MCs to give him his style back, here he comes. If Timothy Taylor was given one chance to spit it again, he would rinse it till it's empty. Lock up to the track like Cynthia. Black youth would come to the forefront, hip hop would feed the masses. No weapon formed against us would prosper or harass us. I'd educate your babies, I'd teach black men to raise them. I'd civilize your ladies, I'd be Captain Save-A-Ho. If Timothy Taylor was given a second chance at life, I'd tell Shahid and Kocha that what we had was right. I wouldn't have let my sister be murdered on the train tracks. I wouldn't have watched my old earth expire in the projects. Intelligence given one chance to make it whole, I'd buy back all your souls. I'd give you crowns of life, I'd bulldoze all the projects, I'd build ghettos of grandeur. Let Jada Kiss ask why I'm here to provide the answers. No longer a need for black folks, see physical labor's cheap. Job market a constant decline, they moving them overseas. Get money, the motor, the ghetto, pitch coca, cap your thing. No love for the poverty stricken, youth click up and form the game. If wise intelligence given a second chance to say this, I wouldn't water it down to compliment your radio playlist. I learned the hard way, there's no such thing as black broadcasters. They're simply puppets at the mercy of their slave masters. Whatever you think, believe in becomes the world around you. Poor people think abundance, riches will soon surround you. If wise intelligence given a chance to do it again, I'd think the thoughts of prophets, I'd rid the world of sin. As Jesus Jones has entered the building, that certain way you feeling about what I be talking about. Well, I wish I was walking out. Never let hate control your thinking. I'm he who speaks believing, who hip-hop fans are seeking. If Timothy Taylor was given a second chance at life, I would probably not even rap. I'd open schools abroad. If wise intelligence blessed with another chance to live, I would live for the love of the people, a little bit closer to God. I'd bind the brokenhearted, free the captive, touch the blind, crush the grapes, save the grace, and prepare the wine. Forgive the sins of our fathers, for which we suffer today. Return the sons of mothers who mourn for Watts to Donnelly Page. I'd organize the gangs, I'd give them the knowledge and know-how. I'd do this like Reginald Lewis, I'd teach them to leverage the buyouts. I'd give them a love for self, I'd wrestle with hell to be right. If Timothy Taylor was given another chance at life.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm your co-host for today, Alexandra Cox. My next interview was with Gina Clayton, who I had an opportunity to talk to at the annual Soros Justice Fellowships Conference, which was held in Baltimore, Maryland this year. Gina and I are fellow Soros Justice Fellows, and we had a small chance to chat during the conference. Gina's just been awarded a fellowship to start an organization called the SE Justice Group, which Megan Comfort sits on the board of.
My name is Gina Clayton, and I'm the founder and executive director of SE Justice Group.
And can you tell me what SE Justice Group does?
Sure. So our mission is to harness the collective power of women with incarcerated loved ones to empower women and end mass incarceration.
And what? How do you do that?
Well, let me start with, if you don't mind, kind of how I got into this. It's always easier for me to kind of start there with the personal experience. So as you know, I'm an attorney. When I was in my first year of law school, I became a woman with an incarcerated loved one. This was in 2007, when someone who I loved was sentenced to 20 years in prison in California. And he's serving that sentence today. And this experience woke me up in a way that nothing ever had. I'd been doing community organizing, race justice work, education equity, work, even criminal justice issues were on my radar. But never had I realized the impact that mass incarceration was having on families, on women, on children, until it happened to me. And it transformed me. I remember, despite the fact that here I was, a first-year law student with a lot of privilege, a lot of resources, a lot of opportunities, I was at Harvard with professors who had cell phone numbers of federal court judges, yet I could do nothing. I felt like I could do nothing. I was walking home from crim law classes to write a sentencing judge in vain, pleading for leniency for the person that I loved that was going through a real experience, not a fake hypothetical experience in a case textbook. So this, for me, was an awakening. And I thought not only about, my situation, but I thought, gosh, if this is what I'm going through, what are all of those mothers, grandmothers, sisters, daughters, wives of people who are going through the system dealing with right now in much harder situations where they have families to raise, where they have three jobs, they don't have the luxury of just going to class every day. That was my life. And I began to think about them. And so when I graduated, I went to the Neighborhood Defender Service of Harlem to build a housing practice, and I met more women. Almost all of my clients were women who were being evicted as a result of some sort of criminal matter. So what this looked like were cases where usually a mother or a grandmother, as a result of some criminal matter that oftentimes was not her own, would end up in housing court fighting tooth and nail for her home, to the place where her grandmothers would come and eat at the kitchen table, the place where that family built memories, that place where they had, roots to the community. She would be fighting, hanging on for literally the stability of her family and her community because of one situation. For example, I had a client who was like so many other of my clients, who her grandson had been arrested, and he didn't live with her, but because he had been arrested blocks away from her apartment, and at that moment of terror, of nervousness, told the arresting officer that he lived at her apartment. So that arresting officer took down her address, and she ended up in eviction court fighting for her home based on nothing more than one statement by one 17-year-old kid to his arresting officer. I saw women like that over and over and over again who were literally under attack by the criminal justice system, but the attack on them looked very different. And so I'm building SE for women like her, to be a place where women can come and heal, can leave those isolating experiences, which we know they are, because you've just lost your loved one into the system. I mean, you feel alone in many respects. And there are women in my organization who talk about that experience as being something like having a family member die. And I know that, for me, I was astonished when I heard this because, I thought, well, how could that be? But the woman who actually told me that had two children, one who passed away and one who was incarcerated, and she describes the experiences similarly. And so, but if you think about that, Alex, if you think about our community response as a society when someone goes to prison, we don't envelope that family with support, with, you know, telling them, oh, take some time off work, here's a little bit of money to help with the costs, here's, you know, a hug. We make them radioactive. We do the opposite. We render them to the margins of society, and we paint them with a red scarlet letter, and we say, go away. And that's exactly the opposite of what these women need. And so what we're building with ESSE, it's really exciting. We're building, we have a curriculum that women have created themselves that is meant to take women from a place of coping with trauma and just being in triage mode to a place of advocacy, strength, and collective voice. And we focus on trauma healing, managing money through crisis, and advocacy. And what we're building is a nationwide network, using our curriculum, a nationwide network for women with incarcerated loved ones.
Wow. And I guess a couple questions come to mind. Why the name ESSE?
So ESSE was the name of my great-grandmother. She passed away a month after I started my work in Harlem. And she looked and reminded me, or the women I met reminded me so much of her. They were matriarchs. They were, you know, the strength of their families and communities. They knew tough love, but they knew love. And that was, we called her Grandmom. We didn't call her ESSE. For family, it was Grandmom. But my great-grandmother was somebody who I grew up hearing her stories directly out of her mouth of being the daughter of sharecroppers in Louisiana when Louisiana was in the top five lynching states in this country, of moving in a great migration from south to west to pursue opportunities for her family, so much like every, you know, many, many other black women during that time. She moved alone with three kids in tow as a single mother, and had three jobs, three kids, and did all of that, and didn't just survive, but she really thrived. She bought homes, she made something of herself. We have these beautiful pictures of her with these beautiful hats. And, you know, and I went to ask, when I asked my grandmother for permission, for a blessing, to use Grandmom's name for the organization, I asked her, I said, well, before I go and tell this story, I want to make sure that I can fact check some of the family lore here. And, you know, like, is this really true that your mom had three kids and three jobs? I knew she had three kids, but did she really hold down three jobs and do it all by herself? How is that possible? And my grandmother was like, oh, baby, yes, you remember, you know this. Of course, I didn't know this, but, you know, she was like, you know this. We had aunts. Your great-grandmother had sisters. And that was it. For me, the strategy, the solutions were already, they're embedded into our history as a people. That sisterhood has always been powerful. And that what we need is to create that sisterhood, to recreate spaces for sisterhood to exist. And so that's why we're naming it after, I've named it after my great-grandmother, because she represents that.
I think the one last question I had was, as someone who's worked in New York and, you know, you're now out in California, why California as the kind of starting place for this nationwide network? What did you see in particular in California that seemed like a sort of unmet need?
Well, California is the second largest prison population in the country. There's a lot of women with incarcerated loved ones as a result. It also happens to be my home state. You know, I'm a California girl at heart. I love all of the states in this country that I've been to. Hope to go to all of them through this work. But I really, you know, California is where my heart and my family is. And so I knew I needed to be there. You know, my incarcerated loved one is there. And so for me, that was where I had to start building. But, you know, one of the things I will say is that incarcerated people, I believe, will build this movement. Because we have a nominations process. The way that we find women isn't through, you know, going and knocking on doors of other organizations or churches or anything like that. We actually ask incarcerated people to partner with us and be our powerful referral network, where men and women who are behind bars can say, you know what, I know a woman just like this. I know a woman who's loving me hard from outside in, and I want her to have community. I want her to be connected. And so all that person ends up doing is writing us, and we get a lot of letters, writing us and tells us all of the amazing things about the girlfriend that they have, or the mother or grandmother, or even a daughter. And we contact that person and we say, you know what, we heard such and such, you know, we got this letter from such and such, and he says that you're phenomenal. And we want to invite you into the loving and powerful community of other phenomenal women who we think you need to know and need to know you. And so that's something that, you know, I just want to share, because so often, you know, folks who are inside don't feel that they can make a difference, don't feel that they can, you know, change the world from where they are. But I believe that in so many ways, I mean, these are our most powerful players in the work that we do to try to end this system's abuses. And so that's just one way for, in terms of our organization, that we try to rebuild families, create those partnerships, and invite incarcerated people in to populate our movement, literally.
It's worldwide, you know, all kinds of issues. Occasionally, but what about so we ought to leave the world tomorrow for our descendants. We should be about to do something about it now.
What up, world? It's Divine, how you doing? Pardon me for not taking time to write sooner. When you hear this, I hope you in the best of health. I really need you, you better take care of yourself. As for your family, I pray that everyone is well. Before I get started, like to take time and tell. My sister's in a struggle, your pain is felt. And my brothers, together we can get through hell. You see, I'm tired of the pain in the world. I can't escape, all they do is hate, debate, scheme on each other. People here, they so mean to each other. They don't see how much we all really need each other. And my pops bounced, cause he ain't wanna be with my mother. Now my stepmoms is like, he ain't really your brother. But I don't care, cause she ain't really my mother. Moms, I love ya for everything you've done, for not taking me out like I'm keeping my son, for knowing and believing your son is the one to lead us all to true freedom. Lead us all to true freedom.
Dear Fred, your pop's voice stays in my head. That's the reason for the name Dead Prez. I'm sick of these heads, knowing the ledge like it's all about their dreads. But I'd rather be bald than have freedom. I'm a member of MPDOM, your whole rule, same organization as you. Plus I'm down with the people on me too. I'm a skinny motherfucker, but I fight for my rights. I'm at the point in my life when I'm about to ignite. Dare to struggle and dare to win. That's what you be kicking when we speak. It's like medicine to the weak. For example, in St. Pete, full-blown rebellion in the streets. It was us against police. Beef, you can gel a revolutionary, but you can't gel a revolution. They can't stop the movement, even though they got you locked away in the maximum institution in Illinois. You stand for what your father was fighting for. I just can't take it no more. I'm going out 24 hours a day, 7 in a row. Whether rain, sleet, sunshine, or snow, eyes open, fists clenched. So if you need something, let me know, y'all. And if you need something, let me know, y'all.
For this is revolutionary love for you and me, you see. Revolutionary love, the only way will be.
You can have my body, you can have my soul, but you can never make me break my warrior's code. You can have my body, you can have my soul, but you can never make me break my warrior's code.
Good morning. This is WGXC 90.7 FM, the Prison Voices Project. Our final interview is with Dr. Danielle Wallace, Assistant Professor of Africana World Studies at William Patterson University. I had the honor of seeing her presentation a few months ago at Monmouth University's biennial conference on race and racism, where she presented a paper on the impact of incarceration on relationships and marriage within the Black community. You began your presentation with President Barack Obama's 2008 Father's Day message to the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago. Why did you begin there?
Well, I thought that that speech was a good place to start because it's, I think, indicative of some of the work that many presidents, starting with Bill Clinton, have done around fatherhood. The Presidential Fatherhood Initiative was started during the Clinton administration to address absentee fathers and to try and get men to be better fathers. And so President Obama's speech really got to the core of that, the fact that there are many fathers missing from Black communities. But I think what is missing from his analysis, even though it's full of admonishments for the Black community and this kind of, you know, shame on you for Black men who are not there for their children, what's missing is a real look at where these fathers are. The assumption is made that they're absent voluntarily, whereas there is a lot more to that issue.
Speaking of Bill Clinton, you also discussed the contradictions of former President Clinton. On one hand, he is praised as the first Black president, but many of his actions while in office negatively impacted Black people, Black men, and the Black family. Can you restate the point that you were trying to make?
Well, the main issue is that, as I said, Clinton started the National Fatherhood Initiative during his administration and during his time as president to address absenteeism among fathers. But at the same time, his administration was instituting some really damaging drug war policies that incarcerated Black men at such high rates that he was essentially helping to create the problem that he was supposed to be addressing. So he was taking men out of their communities, out of their families, and out of their homes, putting them in prison for nonviolent drug offenses, incarcerating them for years at a time for, again, these nonviolent drug offenses, things that they shouldn't have been incarcerated for such a long time, and then wanted to say, well, where are all these fathers? How come they're not in their homes? How come they're not taking care of their children? So he helped to create the problem that he was supposed to be addressing. And he helped to perpetuate it because at the same time, not only does he have these drug war policies that were removing Black men from their homes and communities, but then he was making good on his campaign promise to end welfare as we know it. And he was gutting the federal welfare system and preventing individuals who had been convicted of drug felonies from being able to access any public welfare benefits such as SNAP, better known as food stamps, TANF, getting any kind of access to public housing or federal financial aid for education. So he, you know, there's this criticism of Black men for not being good fathers, but at the same time, there were a lot of policies that Clinton put in their way, a lot of obstacles that he put in the way of Black men who had been incarcerated to be good fathers.
How does incarceration impact Black men differently than Black women in the context of racism and mass incarceration?
Well, I think the major issue is that Black men are, when we talk about who is seen as criminals, Black men are seen as criminals much more so than Black women are. And so when it comes to interactions with police, I think they're targeted in ways that Black women are not. So they tend to have much more experience and exposure to police and law enforcement and to the prison system than Black women do. Black men have been incarcerated at much higher rates than Black women have been, even though Black women are the fastest growing population of incarcerated individuals in this country. Black men have been incarcerated at such rates that, there are millions of Black men in the prison system and not so many Black women. So I think this is, mass incarceration is an issue that is particular to Black men and has a particular effect on Black men that is much greater than the effect it has on Black women.
Given the increased incarceration rates of Black women and other women of color, as you've already stated, how are Black women impacted by mass incarceration?
Well, Black women are impacted, I think, in a number of ways. There's first in regard to relationships and marriage, pool of available men available to heterosexual Black women for marriage is made drastically smaller because of mass incarceration. The imbalance in populations for African Americans occurs beginning at age 20 and only gets worse as men and women get older. This is a difference that doesn't occur in white communities until about the age 45. So that's roughly 20 to 25 years later. So during the time, particularly in the mid-20s, when people tend to be considering marriage, you have a large populational imbalance, and then what happens is that black women, because they outnumber black men in the general population, what happens is that they tend to have less options when it comes to dating and marriage, because if they're not marrying someone who's been incarcerated, then the men who haven't been incarcerated tend to have a lot of power in relationships, and they tend to be able to call the shots. So their options are limited. And then there's an issue of black women who are incarcerated who have issues with their own family life, right? They have restricted access to their children. The majority of incarcerated parents are incarcerated about 100 miles away from where their families live. So that means that they're not going to be able to have regular visits, because visiting prisons can be an expensive thing. So many women don't see their children. Many women don't even speak to their children. About a third of women don't have any kind of phone contact with their children when they're incarcerated. So that means that there's limited access. And then there's also not only the limited access, but then the chance of losing their children while they're incarcerated. The Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1997 was passed to reduce long-term stays in foster care by bringing about quick termination of parental rights and speedy adoption. And under this act, the state is authorized to initiate the termination of parental rights when a child has been living under foster care for 15 of the last 22 months. Now, what this means is, particularly in a time when most women are incarcerated for about 24 months, this means that women whose children go into foster care because of their incarceration may end up losing their children and losing their parental rights and having their children put up for adoption by the state. So that cuts them off directly from their children, because by the time they get out, they've lost all access to them and their kids are essentially living another life.
Since the bulk of your research revolves around marriage and family within the black community, can you give your overall assessment of the impact of mass incarceration on the future of the black family?
Well, I think mass incarceration is not going to destroy the black family. I think the black family has withstood a number of institutions, including enslavement and mass incarceration in the prison industrial complex. It's not going to destroy black families, but it makes it difficult for them to thrive. It makes it difficult for family members to be able to have stable lives, because, again, it's removing men and women from their communities, removing them from their families, removing them from their homes, and preventing them from being able to, in many ways, provide for their family members in a way that is stable and in a way that is successful. So it hinders black families. It's not going to destroy them, because we do have a lot of community safety nets. We do have a lot of extended families that step in to take the place of an incarcerated parent when someone has been imprisoned. But at the same time, again, it makes it very difficult for single parents to be able to take care of their children. It contributes to the amount of single parent households and to the amount of unmarried and single people out there. One of the most important things I think we tend to think of when thinking about marriage and incarceration, we tend to think of the two individuals who are directly involved in a marriage, but it's also important for us to I think recognize the ways in which incarceration affects children, because children, when their parents are incarcerated, are directly affected. About one in every 14 black children in the U.S. has a parent that is incarcerated, compared to one in every 125 white children. So this is something that is directly affecting black communities and directly affecting black children. And it's clearly a racial issue. Right? This is something that is unique to black communities, and therefore something that I think we need to really seriously think about and address, because it's something that can make life difficult, not only for those individuals who are incarcerated, but those who are left behind to deal while they're gone.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be